you were well liked. What would send you to murder a good man in the alley and pilfer his property?
Property was ours, yelled out one of these two. Was the last gift of my uncle, for he was put out on the square.
One of the men in the yellow light cut him off.
Ain't no yours, boy.
God damn you, said the man on the line. Was my uncle's. You best not color his name.
At that, the man standing next to him said, Shut up, Billy. We got enough of it already.
Another man yelled from the yellow light.
Don't you worry yourself, boy. We will feed him his manners well enough.
The ordinary man now walked toward the center of the line.
Y'all wish to run, he said. Well, by God, I was not constructed to stand against the will of any man or any niggers.
The ordinary man walked back toward the wagon, climbed atop its seat, and stood.
Here is what we're gonna do. You are now in the care of these Virginia gentlemen. They have agreed to give you an allotment of time to go. Outdistance them for the whole of this evening, and freedom is yours. But if they catch you, your whole life is at their mercy. Maybe you'll make it out and your sins will be wiped. More likely, you won't make it an hour before justice finds you. Makes no difference to me. I did my service. Time come for you to do yours.
Then he sat down, took the reins, and the wagon rumbled off. We stood there, looking around into the night, looking at each other for some clue, perhaps waiting, hoping, even amidst our gripping fear that some jest would be revealed. We were too stunned to move. I looked over at the white men, the apparitions in their wide-brim hats, who now stood waiting for us to apprehend the fact of our situation. And then, his patience exhausted, one of these whites broke from the group and walked over to the rough line of us. He was holding a cudgel. He took this cudgel and smashed it over the head of one of the tasking men, now branded renegade. The tasking man seemed in disbelief as it happened, for he made no effort to block the blow. But he screamed out as it took effect, and then crumpled on the ground. The man with the cudgel now turned to the rest of the line and said,
Best to get to getting, boys.
Everyone scattered at once. I ran too, with one look back toward the fallen man, a dark heap against a greater enveloping darkness that now gathered behind me. I ran alone. I suspect we all did. There was no effort among the tasked assembled there to cooperate. Perhaps among those two brothers, Davis and Billy, but if the terror that struck me when that man was cudgeled struck them, if they had been held under as I had, then likely there was no time for thinking, no time for loyalty. And so I ran, but neither fast nor, as it turned out, far. Hunger stole my will. The cramps turned my limbs to wood. The night wind cut against me, and now, more loping than running, I noticed that the ground beneath me was uncertain and wet, and even the soft tug of the mud added to my weight. And where was I now running to? What is north but a word? The underground, the swamps, but a myth spread by the villain Georgie Parks? And what hope had I to elude this pack of predators? And even in this terror and despair, I didn't think to fall down in the road or to surrender myself. The light of freedom had been reduced to embers, but it was still shining in me, and borne up by the winds of fear, I kept running, bent, loping, locked, but running all the same, with my whole chest aflame. The night was lit up by the power of my adapting eyes, so that wet and wintry forest was all laid out before me. And I heard my brogans sinking into the ground with every step, the twigs snapping under me, and I heard a shot in the distance, and I wondered if they'd caught one of us, killed one of us. The drum in my chest boomed louder. In my path I saw the skinny trunk of a fallen tree, which I told myself to leap over as I ran, but my body gave me up. I fell, and there was now mud in my nose, mud in my mouth, and I remember the feeling of relief coming over me, relief from all my muscles finally at rest. But even then, even down there, I could still see the light of freedom, dim and blue. I heard voices now, a muddle of cries and yells, and I knew that soon they would be upon me. Rise, I told myself, rise. Slowly now my fingers grasped at the mud, my palms pushed in deep, and I was then on my hands and knees. Rise! And one knee was up, and then another, and then I was standing again. But no sooner was I up than I felt the cudgel crack across my back. I fell, and they were all over me again, kicking, punching, spitting, cursing, violating. I did not fight them off. I left my body, flew, soared even, back to Lochless, back down on the street with Thina, back to the garden with old Pete, back beneath the gazebo with Sophia, so that when they roped my arms and dragged me off, when I felt the wagon wheels rumbling beneath me, I was barely aware of it. I remember everything, I tell you. I remember it all except those moments when I gave up memory, when I left my body and flew away. They brought me back before the ordinary man, all roped and trussed. I did not even look at him. They blindfolded me and tossed me into the back of another wagon, and, after a short ride, tossed me into the same pit from which my ordeal began. This hunt became my routine. I would be pulled up from the pit, given a pittance of bread and water, put into file with a group of renegades, who were addressed with all their crimes, and then sent to run. I remember the names, how the ordinary man would read them in his low, gravelly voice. Ross, Healy, Dan, Edgar, and each night we were made to run, and each night I was defeated, and each night returned to my pit. Had I died? Was this the hell of which my father spoke? Some nights I would be out running for hours, and I could swear I saw the soft glimmer of dawn, its borders at my fingertips. Then I would be taken, beaten, and tossed right back into the box, where the carousel of dreams and visions awaited. I am watching Sophia water dance by the fire. I'm watching Jack and Arabella flick marbles in the ring. I'm gathering the task for Maynard to run. But I grew stronger. I grew faster. And this began not with the body, but with the mind. For I found that when in the right mind, I ran faster and farther. And if I were to ever win this twisted game, I would need all the assets I could manage. And so, in my mind, I began to call out the very anthems that Lem and I exchanged that last holiday. Going away to the great house farm, going up to where the house is warm. When you look for me, Gina, I'll be far gone. The song powered me, for it reminded me of Lem and the holiday, Thina and Sophia, and all of us gathered together. Even in the darkness, some part of me smiled. And I felt freedom, brief as it was, in those nights of flight. Even as I was hunted, I felt it in the cold wind cutting against my face, the branch scratching my cheek, the mud under my brogans, the heaving heat of my breath. No Maynard yanking at me, no trying to discern the motives of my father, no creeping fear of Corrine. Out here, it was all so clear. In running, I felt myself to be in a kind of defiance. And I was growing crafty. I remember being out one night for what must have been hours, and I knew it had been hours because by the time they'd finished with me and hauled me back, pummeled and beaten, to the ordinary man, I saw something incredible. The sun, rising over what I could now see as green hills. And remembering the promise made to me of freedom, I knew that I was close. I learned to cover my tracks, to double back over them so as to confuse them, and learned, too, that I could track them as sure as they tracked me. And I realized that I had a gift that I could bring to bear, my memory. It was always the same crew, and they were unoriginal in their workings. Memorizing the terrain and their habits gave me a sudden advantage. I would find my way to their flank. One night, they split up. I felled one and pummeled another. They gave me an extra hard licking for that one, and I was forced to confess the limits of my operation. I was running when what I needed was to fly, not just in my mind, but in this world I needed to lift up away from these low whites as I lifted away from Maynard and the river. But how? What was that power that could pull a man out of the depths, that could pull a boy out of the stables and into the loft? I began to reconstruct events. Both of those uncanny moments featured blue light, and both brought me, in different ways, close to my mother, or to the dark hole in my memory where I'd lost her. The power must have some relation to my mother, and I needed the power because I needed to fly, or I would die trying to outrun these wolves. Maybe the power was in some way related to the block in my memory, and to unlock one was, perhaps, to unlock the other. And so, in those dark and timeless hours in the pit, it became my ritual to reconstruct everything I had heard of her and all that I had seen of her in those moments down in the Goose. Rose of the kindest heart, Rose, sister of Emma, Rose the beautiful, Rose the silent, Rose the water dancer. It was a cloudless night, and I was running. I could feel that it was now spring, for the nights were no longer so fierce upon me. My heart no longer pounded against my chest as I ran. My legs were fluid. And the men must have known this, for I had noticed that they had increased their numbers, and whereas before they would split up to pursue the whole line of fugitives, I now began to feel that the entire team was focused on me above all the others. So it was that night that I heard them closing in, and then the forest opened up, and I saw a pond glistening, wide and dark. I had to make an effort around the water. I could hear the cries and whoops of the men behind me. I pushed around the pond as hard as I could, the voices of the men steadily closing, and I dared not look back. And then my foot caught on something, a branch or a root, I cannot be sure, and a sharp pain, an old pain, shot up through my ankle. I felt myself falling, and then I was down in the fens, and I felt the cold, muddy water on my face. I crawled for a moment, but delirious with pain, and knowing the hunt was over, I called out, but this time not in my mind, but out loud, and for all to hear.
Going away to the Great House Farm, going up but won't be long. Be back, Gina, with my heart and my song.
What did the men pursuing me see in that moment? Did they even hear me calling out? They were right on me, ready to lay on hands, perhaps reaching at that moment. Did they see the air open in front of them, the blue light of all our stories knifing through the world, illuminating the night? What I saw was the woods folding back against themselves, a rolling mist, and beneath it a bolding green that I immediately recognized as belonging to Lochless. That was my first thought, but then as the scene came upon me, and that was how it felt, like the world was drawing to me more than I was drawing to it, I saw that this was not the Lochless of my time, for there were Tassing folk who I knew to no longer be with us. And directing them, I saw, as I remembered him all those years, laughing and thoughtless, little May. He was pointing back at the house, yelling something, and drawn to that direction, I saw that he was yelling at me. Not me floating above, but me on the ground, in time, in that first year of service, stripped from the instruction of Mr. Fields, still apprehending my place in things. The moment struck me not as another turn on the carousel, but wholly new. It was like being asleep and never recognizing, no matter the absurdity of things, that you are in a dream. The very nature of logic and expectation was bent, and the absurd struck me as normal. So I simply observed myself, observed Maynard, as we had been in that other time. Even as I watched this younger me cornered off with another group of Tasking folks and lined up to run, even as I saw myself racing off, even as I felt myself to be racing with them, though my legs were not moving, I did not understand. I watched as I separated myself from the line faster than all of them, and touching the tip of the field, I saw myself turn back and then trip, scream, and fall, grabbing at my ankle. I remember wanting to comfort this child, this me from another life. But when I moved to him, the world again peeled away, and I was back in my own time. But not in my own place. Pain again shot through my ankle. I was on the ground, howling. I tried to crawl, and then I stood. I took one step. It was agony. I fell. And again I felt myself slipping under. I looked up one last time and saw one of the men standing over me. No, a different one now.
"Quiet down, boy," Hawkins said. "The way you hollering, liable to wake the dead."
Chapter 12. I was brought back by the pain in my ankle. It was no longer the sharp stab from before, but a dull throbbing. I opened my eyes and saw the daylight, the beautiful daylight that I hadn't seen in weeks, blaring through a window like a horn, so loud that the rest of the world blurred before me. Slowly my eyes shifted so that the blur began to take shape, a table by the bedside with a pipe hooked onto a vase shaped like a ship, a large clock on a ledge across from me, and above my head a canopy and scarlet-red curtains pulled back. I looked down and saw that I had been fully washed and fitted in cotton drawers and a silk nightshirt. It occurred to me that I might still be down under, and this just another turn on the carousel. Or perhaps I had ascended out of the hell of my dungeon and gone at last to my reward. But the dull throbbing of my ankle signaled that the world around me was real. And I saw that I was not alone, for there were figures, too, forming out of the blur. One was Hawkins, the man who had now twice found me on the other end of miraculous flight. He was seated in a chair, and next to him, no longer in her mourning clothes, I saw the forsaken bride of Maynard Walker, Corrine Quinn.
"Welcome," she said.
She was smiling, smiling joyously even, and I was aware that I had never seen her smile in such a way before. It was as if she had discovered something lost ages ago, a key perhaps, or the final piece of a puzzle that had so long vexed and discomfited her. But there was something more, something in her manner, for she was smiling at me, not smiling upon me. Her manner had always been bizarre and unlike anything I had ever seen among the quality, but this was different still, for there was nothing masterful nor certain, no dominance in her manner, only a deep pleasure, a satisfaction at some unseen goal having been attained.
"Do you know what has happened to you?" she asked. "Do you know where you are?"
There was the smell of spring potpourri, a sharp, sweet mix of mint, thyme, and something else. A scent that would never be of Lochless, where a boyish spirit prevailed and didn't allow for such things. "Do you know how long you've been gone?" she asked. I said nothing.
"Hiram," she said, "do you know who I am?"
"Miss Corrine," I answered.
"No, miss," she said,
her joyous smile now relaxing into a look of confirmation.
"Corrine. Only ever Corrine."
The unnaturalness of the moment now expanded. I saw, looking over, that Hawkins was not standing in wait as a tasking man should, but was seated right next to her, with his posture upright and erect. Again she asked,
"Do you know where you are?"
"No," I replied. "I don't know how long I have been gone. I don't know where I've been gone to. I don't even know why."
"Hiram," she said, "we are going to have an agreement, an understanding. I will be truthful with you, and in turn, you will do the same for me."
Now she stared hard at me.
"You know well why you were sent away," she said. "You ran, taking another with you. Surely by now you have guessed that we have intelligence greater than your own. I will tell you anything, but you must do the same.
I moved to sit up in the bed and felt a sharp pain in my back and legs. My feet were cracked and sore. I felt my face and found a knot above my left eye, and I remembered the nightly ordeal I had suffered, the hours spent in the pit.
"Yeah, we're sorry about that. Had to be sure," Hawkins now gave a look of acknowledgement and said. "Had some notions, but to be sure, had to carry you off."
"We're sorry," he'd said, implying that Hawkins, a tasking man, had some power here, not just in this room, but in all the hell that I had journeyed through for what had been, what, a month? Months?
"Hiram," said Corrine, "you went into the Goose River with Maynard.
No, you took Maynard into the Goose River. He had no choice in the thing.
Perhaps you wanted this, but want or not, you killed a man, and in doing so sent long-drawn plans to dust. For your impulse and desire for your crime, great men must now reapportion their lives, and whole armies of American justice are now in flight. You do not understand, but I think you shall. For it is my belief that in your wild thrashings there was a design, greater still than even our own."
As she spoke, Corrine unhooked the pipe from the vase with her left hand and with her right took the top off. The smell of tobacco now wafted out. She lit the pipe, pulled, and puffed out a plume of smoke. Then she handed the pipe to Hawkins, who relit, puffed, and handed the pipe back to her. White smoke flooded up from them and hung like dust on the sunlight cutting through the window. I thought back to the last conference, in that low-lit parlor of Lochless, where her voice quavered and trembled, and I remembered how odd she was even then, how odd she'd always been, how she seemed to eschew the fashion of the moment for a Virginia of old, and how conspicuous and wrong it all really was. But now I saw the truth. So suddenly, I wondered how I had never seen it before. It was a lie. The whole thing was a lie. The tradition, the mourning, perhaps even the marriage itself. I must have lost all my covert powers while away, for Corrine looked at me and laughed and said, "You are wondering how I did it, aren't you?"
"I am," I said. "Yes? Yes, I understand, I truly do," she said. "It is a rare thing for any lord or lady of the estate to truly fool the servant. It is a luxury to be so grandly deceived, to live among perjury and invention. Whatever your aspirations, Hiram, I know that you have never enjoyed such splendor. You are a scientist. You have to be. But these fools, these Jeffersons, these Madisons, these Walkers, all dazzled by theory, well, I am convinced that the most degraded field hand on the most miserable plot in Mississippi knew more of the world than any overstuffed, fourth-holding American philosoph. And the lords and ladies of our country know this. This is why they are so enthralled of the dance and song of your people. It is an unwritten library, stuffed with a knowledge of this tragic world such that it defies language itself. Power makes slaves of masters, for it cuts them away from the world they claim to comprehend. But I have given up my power, you see, given it up, so that now I might begin to see."
She held the pipe in her hand and shook her head.
"Yes, you do see, you do understand, but you are not yet wise. Your pursuit of this design, your embrace of a man who is in fact a villain, well, this thing with you, this conduction that pulled you out of the river, you are not the first, you know. You know the story. Santy Bess and the 48 Coloreds. That never happened,"
I interrupted.
"Indeed, it did," Corrine said. "And its implications are the very reason you find yourself here before us. Did you know that before her departure there was no Freetown in Starfall?
Did you know that Georgie's entire treachery of slavery and liberators' clothes is really the treachery of the lords of this country?
At the mention of Georgie's name, memories flowed back, old memories of a man who had been as family. Thoughts of Amber and their baby. Had Amber known? I thought of our last conversation, how she tried to dissuade me, and I wondered at what precise moment Georgie decided to hand me off. And I wondered how many he had handed off before me.
"It's a good trick," Hawkins said. "Gotta give him that. They give shelter to Georgie and his pals, and he gives them intelligence and eyes. So the next time a Santy Bess come, he layin' in wait."
"But that can't happen, can it, Hiram?" said Corrine. "Because Santy worked by a different power. The same power that pulled you out of the River Goose, the same power that freed you from our patrol."
Now I looked around the room. Things began to assemble together, and a set of questions slowly formed, but all I managed to ask was one. "What is this?" Corrine reached for a handbag. She produced a paper and held it up.
"You were given to me, body and soul, by your father," she explained. "He signed you over because your flight disgraced him. It was another blow to his heart, already weakened by the loss of Maynard, and he answered the blow with rage. He wanted nothing to do with you, but I convinced him that you were too valuable to lose, and so he signed you over to me, for a healthy price, of course."
Now she rose and walked over to the door.
"But you are not mine," she said,
and at that she opened the door. I could see stairs in the upper portion of a banister.
"You are not a slave, not to your father, not to me, not to anyone. You asked what this was? It is freedom."
These words did not fill me with delight. The questions now overran me. Where had I been? Why was I left in a hole? How long had I been under? What happened to the ordinary man? And more than anything, what had become of Sophia? Corrine returned to her seat.
"But freedom, true freedom, is a master too, you see. One more dogged, more constant than any ragged slave driver," she said. "What you must now accept is that all of us are bound to something. Some will bind themselves to property in man and all that comes forthwith, and others shall bind themselves to justice. All must name a master to serve. All must choose. We have chosen this, Hawkins and I. We have accepted the gospel that says our freedom is a call to war against unfreedom. Because that is who we are, Hiram, the underground. We are who you were searching for. But you found Georgie Parks first. I am sorry about that. At great expense and risking exposure, we retrieved you. But this was not done for your benefit because we have long seen in you something of incredible value, some artifact of a lost world, a weapon that might turn the tide in this longest war. You know of what I speak, do you not?"
I did not reply. Instead, I asked, "Where is Sophia? What happened to her?"
"There are limits to our powers, Hiram," Corrine said.
"But you say you are the underground," I said. If you are who you say you are, why didn't you free her? Why did you leave me in that jail? Why did you leave me in that hole? Do you know what has happened to me?"
"No," asked Hawkins. "We caused it to happen to you. We authored it. And as for your freedom, there is a reason we are the underground, and a reason we've lived to fight so long. There are rules. There is a reason you found Georgie before you found us."
"Every night, those men hunted me," I said, the anger growing in me, "and you let them do it. No, worse, you sent them to do this?"
"Hiram," said Corrine, "I am sorry. But that hunt was but a preview of your life now. And that dungeon was but a glimpse of the price of your failure. Your life was over the minute you engaged with Georgie Parks. Would you prefer we left you to that?"
Hawkins speaks the truth. We had to be sure.
What did you have to be sure of? I asked.
That you really did carry the power of Santi Bess, of conduction, Corinne said. And you do. Twice now we have seen it made manifest. Surely it was the work of our Lord for Hawkins to find you the first time, and inquiring, we discovered from others that you'd once talked wildly about something much the same happening to you as a child. We needed to wait for it to happen again. We calculated where the power might send you, and we waited for you to arrive.
Arrive where? I asked.
At Lochless, she said. We thought you might be trying to get back to the only home you've ever known. We had agents watching for you every night.
And here you are, said Hawkins. And where am I? I asked.
Somewhere safe, said Corinne. Where we bring all those newly married to our cause?
She paused for a second here. I saw a hint of sympathy in her face, and I knew that she was not relishing any of this, that she had some sense of my pain and confusion.
There is so much that you must understand, I know. We will explain, I promise you this, but you must trust us. And you must trust us because there is no going back. Right now, there is nothing else true in this world. And soon you shall see that there is nothing else truer than our cause.
At that, Corinne and Hawkins rose.
Soon, she said as they left, soon you will understand it all. Soon you shall singularly comprehend, and then your comprehension will be a new binding. And in this binding, in this high duty, you will find your true nature.
Now she paused at the door and uttered words that felt like prophecy.
You are not a slave, Hiram Walker, said Corinne. But by Gabriel's ghost, you shall serve.
Chapter 13. That evening, still lying in bed, I heard voices downstairs and the smell of what I hoped to be supper. I had not enjoyed a proper meal since my flight from Lochless. This all combined to rouse me from my stupor. I saw now upon the bureau there were two washing pans filled with water, a toothbrush, dentifrice, and a set of clothes. I cleaned and changed and then limped downstairs across a foyer and into an open dining room where I saw Corinne, Hawkins, Amy, three other coloreds, and none other than Mr. Fields. I stood in the doorway for a moment until he saw me. He was laughing at some story Hawkins was relating, but when he saw me, his smile turned grave and he looked to Corinne, who now looked to me, and then the whole table turned to me in the most solemn way imaginable. They were seated before a veritable feast, but all of them, black and white, man and woman, were dressed in work clothes.
"Please, Hiram," Corinne said. "Join us."
I walked in gingerly and took an empty seat near the end, next to Amy and across from Mr. Fields. We had stewed okra and sweet potatoes. We had greens and baked shad. There were salt pork and apples, some type of bird stuffed with rice and mushrooms, bread, pudding, dumplings, black cake, ale. It was the most indulgent meal I'd ever had. But more incredible than the meal was what happened after. Corinne rose first and then the others, and all together they began to clean the dishes and reset the dining room. It was an incredible sight. There was no division. Everyone moved together, everyone except me. I tried to help but was refused. When the cleanup was done, they all retired to the parlor and I watched as they played Blind Man's Buff late into the night. It occurred to me both by their jolly nature and their stray comments that this was not the usual evening, that something had changed warranting this celebration, and that the something was me. I stayed that night in the house, in what was the guest chambers, sleeping long and late into the afternoon. I had never engaged in such luxury, not even during holiday. I washed and dressed and then walked downstairs. The house was quiet, On the kitchen table there was a pan of rye muffins with a note next to it directing me to indulge. After devouring two muffins, I cleaned my dish, walked out the front door, and took a seat on the porch. From the outside, the house was modest and quaint, covered in white clapboard. There was a garden out front filled with blooming snowdrops and bluebells. Past the garden, there was a bank of woods, and then in the distance I saw the majestic peaks of what I knew to be the Western Mountains. I surmised that I was likely at the border of Virginia, most probably in Bryston, Corrine's family's stead, the same manse where she'd told me months ago she would have me delivered. In the distance, I saw two figures emerging from the woods. They walked toward the house, and I could soon discern that they were two white men, one older, one younger, a father and son, perhaps. When they saw me, they stopped. The younger one nodded in greeting, but the older man grabbed him by the arm and pulled him back to the woods. I sat there for an hour, looking out, and at some point fell into a daydream, and then, obviously more fatigued than I thought, into an actual dream. And I was back in my cell again, but this time with Pete and Thina. And when the men pulled me out to the front parlor, Pete and Thina laughed. And I could hear their laughter through the entire ordeal as men inspected me, violated me. I could not at that time yet see this as such, as violation. It took time to learn how to speak of what was done to me directly, to tell the story of my time in Ryland's jail as it was, and not feel my manhood fleeting from me. It took time for me to see that the story really was my greatest power. But back then, when I awoke from the dream, all I felt was a burning anger. I had never been a violent boy. I did not have much of a temper. But for years after this, I found myself randomly filled up with the most destructive thoughts and feelings, and unable to truly admit to why. I was awakened by a door closing behind me. I looked back and saw that it was Amy. She walked out and stood on the porch for a moment, looking out as the now-setting sun fell over the mountains. She wore neither a morning gown nor black veil, but a gray hoop dress with a white apron across the front. Her hair was pulled back behind a bonnet.
"I am supposing you have questions," she said.
Yes, I had many, but I offered none of them. It was my feeling that I had asked enough already, by which I mean I had told them enough already because I'd learned in my first life that interrogation is never one way. Until Amy said,
"All right, I understand. I must suppose that were I you right now, I would not be much for talking myself. Nevertheless, I'm talking because there are things about this place, about this new life, that you should know."
Out of the side of my eye, I now saw her looking at me, but I held my eyes on the mountains and the sun drawing to a close over them.
"You have probably guessed where you are. Bryston, Corrine's place. But you have not guessed and cannot know what her place really is. I might as well tell you. You will see it soon enough. Bryston used to belong to Corrine's folks, seeing as how she was the onlyest when they died, the estate fell to her. I guess you know by now Corrine ain't what she seemed. Oh, she is Virginia through and through, but by cause of what she's seen right here and some knowledge acquired up north, she takes, shall we say, a different view of the slavery question. And her view, which is my view and my brother's view, is quarrelsome and wrathy."
Here Emmy laughed lightly and paused for a moment and said,
I should not laugh. It is not funny, except when it is, which I must say is all the time to me. It is a blessing to be here, to be at war with them. We are an outpost in that army that you now know as the Underground. Everyone living here is part of that army, though we can give no tell of such things. If you walked with me now, you would see what anyone would expect. Orchards blooming, fields all lush. And if we were entertaining, you'd see us all at work, singing and happy. But understand that every single one of those you would see singing and working here are with us, and have dedicated themselves to extending the light of freedom into Maryland Virginia, Kentucky, and even into Tennessee. They're all agents, though they work in different ways. Some of them work from the house. They're read as you are and have put that skill to use. Paper is important in this. Freedom papers, wills, and testaments. It's the house, I know. But believe me, they are a wild bunch. The house agents always got an ear to the ground. They study. They know the gossip. They know the journals. They know everyone of influence in their region. But no one in their region really knows them. And then there are others.
Amy paused here, and when I looked over, I saw a half-smile had crawled up the corner of her mouth. She was now looking out to the mountains herself, watching as they consumed the last morsel of sun.
"You see that there?"
she asked. I did not answer.
"That there is what it is. Sitting here watching the sun set on your own time, with nothing over you and no one to command you or threaten a 7 and 9. It was not always this way for me. I was with my brother tied to the meanest man in the world, and that man married Corrine, and, well, that man is not with us anymore, and I am here with you able to enjoy small natural things such as this. But there are others who cannot be remanded to a house, for they feel the walls pushing in. They are the ones who remember the first time they ran, and it was so glorious to them to be in defiance against everything they had ever been told. It is the most free they ever felt, and they are left in chase of that freedom. That is the field agent. The field agents are different. They go into plantations and lead the task up off of them. The field agents are daring. The hounds make them feel alive. The swamp, the river, the bramble, the abandoned stead, the loft, the old barn, the moss, the north star. That's the field agent. And we need each other. We work together. Same army, Hiram, same army.
She went quiet again at that, and we sat there looking at the evening sky and the stars speaking out.
"And what are you?" I asked. "Hmm?"
House or field, I said. "What are you?" She looked at me, snorted, laughed, and said,
"I'm a field agent, of course."
Then she looked back toward the mountains, which were now just dark blue hulks in the distance.
"Hiram? I could run right now, even free as I am. Run from nothing. Run right past them mounds, past all the rivers, through every prairie, sleeping in swamps, feeding off roots. And then after all that, I could run some more."
So, I was trained to be an agent. Trained in the mountains of Bryston, Corrine's family stead, along with the other new agents recruited for the underground. You will forgive me for not saying much about my fellow agents. Those who are mentioned in this volume are either alive and have tendered their permission or have gone off to that final journey to meet with the Grand Discerner of Souls. We are not yet past a time when scores are settled and vengeances sought. So many of us must, even in this time, remain underground. My life now doubled. I resumed my regular interest in woodworking and the crafting of furniture, and I acted as I had, helping among the folk who worked at Bryston, though they worked in a manner then most strange to me. There was no division in labor along any front. The kitchen, the dairy, the mechanics workshop were worked by all, regardless of sex and color, so that should Corrine Quinn be without business abroad, it was nothing to see her out among the crops or serving supper with Hawkins in the shotgun dining hall, where we together assembled nightly. After supper, we would return to our barracks and change from our dinner garb to the uniform of the night, flannel shirt, elastic-bound trousers, and light canvas shoes. Then we would report for that first phase of training. We ran for an hour every night, covering, by my estimation, 6 to 7 miles. Mixed in with these miles were breaks for all manners of calisthenics, arm raises, leaning rest, hops, etc. And then after our run there was more, sideways lunges, leg lifts, knee bends, etc. The regimen was derived from the German 48ers, men who'd fought for liberty in their old country and found common cause here in the underground. Whatever their origins, they made me stronger. The burning in my chest diminished to the slightest discomfort, and I found that I could cover wide spans of country without rest. There were no tasking men among these instructors, only the quality and the low. Some of them, I suspected, were among the men who had once regularly hunted me. I don't know if I ever got over this. I felt myself disposable to them, at least to this portion in Virginia who were, to my mind, zealots. And though I know they had to be, that there was no other way for them to be, it meant a certain distance between us, for their war was against the task, and mine would be a war for those who were tasked. As it happened, there was one exception, though I wonder now if this was because he was not Virginian, but a native of the North. That was Mr. Fields, whom I met with for an hour thrice weekly after my calisthenics, beneath the house in a sprawling sub-basement accessible only by a trap door, which one accessed by stepping through a large mahogany marriage chest whose bottom had been cut out. Down two sets of stairs, there was another door, behind which lay a musky, lantern-lit study, with two rows of bookshelves on each side, stuffed end to end. In the middle of the room, there was a long table with equidistant seats, and at each seat there was pen and paper. In the farthest corner, there were two large secretaries, the pigeonholes of which were filled with various papers pertaining to the underground, tools of the house agents who, some nights, I saw down there at the long table quietly executing their stealthy craft. I would sit at the table with Mr. Fields, who took up our studies as though nothing had ever occurred between us, as though the span of years had not even happened. My curriculum now expanded, and I was happy for this. Geometry, arithmetic, some Greek and Latin. And then for one remaining hour, I was given free run of the offices and left to choose among the volumes. I think now that my own volume, the one that you now hold here, began there in those moments, in that library. For eventually I began not simply to read, but to write. At first it was merely a record of my studies, but soon this record expanded to my thoughts, and then from my thoughts to my impressions, so that I now possessed not merely a record of my head, but of my heart. From where did such an idea originate? I guess I must thank Maynard. Among the effects he pilfered from my father's own pigeonholed secretary was an old journal kept by our grandfather, John Walker, who, in keeping with his generation, believed himself to be in the midst of a grand struggle that would alter the face of the world. I didn't have such pretensions, but I did sense, however dimly, that I had, however incidentally, caught on to something significant beyond my small life. I continued this routine for a month, with little alteration until one evening, when I went down underneath the house and there was Corrine in place of Mr. Fields. "And how are you finding things here?" she said. "Most strange," I said. "It is another life." Corrine yawned quietly and sat down. She put her elbow on the desk and her chin in her palm, regarding me with tired eyes. Her hair was pulled back in black curls. The lantern light tumbled shadows onto her face. Her aspect was of an ancestress, though she barely outranked me in years. I recalled her time with Maynard and felt myself becoming enthralled by the breadth of her deception. How little I had known of her then, her intelligence, her savvy, her cunning. Then I felt a shock of fear roil through me. Corrine Quinn, who wore the mask of quality, was mysterious and powerful, and I had no real notion of her capacities. "Even you," I said. "It is a lot to consider. I would never have imagined, not in 1,000 years.
"Thank you," she said,
and she laughed, clearly delighted in the grand sweep of her deception.
"Do you enjoy the writing?"
"I have seen so much lately," I replied. "I have felt a need to record it, especially my experiences here."
"Careful with that," she said.
I know, I said. It dies with me. It does not leave here.
Hmm,
she said, her eyes now alight.
I have heard that you have made the library your quarters, she said, and that some nights you have to be practically dragged from its depths.
It reminds me of home, I said.
And would you go back if you could? Home? She asked.
No. Never, I said. She studied me for a moment now. For what, I could not be sure. They were always studying me down there. I could feel it, even my fellow agents in training. It seemed always probing me with questions, watching me when they thought I was not looking. I answered them with as much silence as possible. But there was something about Corrine that compelled me to speak. There was something to her own silence that communicated a deep and particular loneliness. And though we never spoke directly upon the origins of this feeling, I felt it to be cousin to my own. When I was down back there, back at Lochless, I said, I had my freedoms, more than most, I should say, but I was still property of another man. Even speaking it as such, here, right now, to you, lowers me.
Indeed, she said, and some of us have been down since the days of Rome. Some of us are born into society and told that knowledge is rightfully beyond us, and ornamental ignorance should be our whole aspiration.
She chuckled and paused a moment, waiting for me to catch her meaning. And when it was apparent that I did, she said,
"The mind of woman is weak. This was the word, you see. But now they say that any and all who would aspire to the rank of lady must have some touch of the book, but not too much. No hard study, nothing that might injure the delicate and girlish mind. Novels, tales, proverbs, that sort of thing. No papers, no politics."
Now Corrine stood and walked over to the desk, and from the desk drawer she retrieved a large envelope.
"But I have not let them dictate to me, Hiram," she said, holding the envelope. "And I have not simply read, my boy. I have learned their language and custom, even those that should be beyond my station, especially those that should be beyond my station, and that has been the seed of my liberty."
She walked back over and placed a package before me.
"Open it," she said.
This I did, and found inside of it the life of a man. There were letters to family, there were authorizations, there were certificates of sale.
"This is yours for 1 week," she said. "We can't hold on to this man's effects forever. What we have here is a selection, random enough so that its absence should not yet alarm him."
"And what am I to do?" I asked.
"Learn him, of course," she said. "This is a lesson in their customs, a way of comprehending all of those things beyond your station. He is a gentleman of some education and schooling, as are many of the great slaveholders in this country."
I must have looked confused, because Corrine now said,
"What do you think you've been studying down here?"
I said nothing. She continued on.
"What we do is not idle exercise, nor Christian improvement. First you learn what they know in the general, and then you learn them in the specific, their words and their hand. Own the man's especial knowledge, and you shall own the measure of the man. Then you might fashion the costume, Hiram, and make it yours to fit."
I began my study the very next day. Quickly, I ascertained that all the documents were drawn up by the same hand. Studying them, a portrait began to emerge. From the artifacts of the author's life, the balance of his ledgers, his communications with his wife, his journal entries upon certain deaths, the accounting of consecutive harvests, the man, in all his traits and foibles, was summoned before me. I saw his daily habits, his routines, his particular philosophy, and by the final hour, having never known him, I could render nearly all of his features. Corrine met me again a week later in the library. I provided her with all I had ascertained, and under her rigorous interrogation, I provided even more. What was his wife's favorite flower? How regular were their departures? Did this man love his father? Had he yet turned gray? Where did he stand in society, and how ancient was his fortune? Was he given to the infliction of random cruelties? I responded to every query. I had, with my gift of memory, inhaled all the facts of the man's life. But Corrine pushed on to questions that went beyond the facts that might be committed to memory, to matters of interpretation. Was he a good man? What did he covet in life? Was he the sort to revel in perceived wrongs? The next night she picked up this line of inquiry and pushed me to construct the man down to the last loose thread of his waistcoat. On the following night of interrogation, I found that the more speculative questions came easier, and then by the last night, they were so easy that I felt them to be matters of my own life. And that was the point of it all. "Now," she said, "you have read well enough to know this man to be in possession of a particular property of which he is most fond." "The jockey, yes," I replied. "Levity Williams." "The same," she said. "This man will need a day pass for the road, a letter of introductions for the further portion, and finally free papers signed by his master. You will provide these." She pulled from her case a tin and handed it to me. Opening it, I saw a fine pen, and by handling it, I knew it was the same weight as the one so often employed by the object of my study. "Hiram, the costume must fit," she said. "The day pass must be done with the same hurried disregard. The letters must have all that official flourish, and the freedom papers the same arrogance that is surely the right of these vile people." There was still the practical fact of copying his signature and penmanship. But here my memory and gift for mimicry triumphed. It was no different than what I'd done all those years ago when Mr. Fields showed me the image of the bridge. Harder were the man's beliefs and passions, and my ability to convey them with confidence and ease, as though they were my own. I never forgot that lesson. It was essential to what I became, to what I unlocked and saw. I don't know if those documents ever loosed Levity Williams. Everything we did was done under so much secrecy. But still, in forging these documents, I felt something new arising in me, and the new thing was power. The power extended out from my right arm, projected itself through the pen, and shot out through the wilderness, right at the heart of those who condemned us. Soon this became regular labor. Every few weeks, Corrine presented me with a new package, and each week I fitted myself to the costume, so that when I finished, I was sometimes unsure of where I ended and where the taskmaster began. I knew them. I knew their children, their wives, their enemies. Their humanity wounded me, for here too were the bonds of family, and here too were young lovers overrun by the rituals of courting, and here too lay a sorrow, a grim understanding of the sin of the task. And here too were fears that in the last calculation they too were slaves to some power, some god, some demon of the old world, which they had unknowingly unleashed upon the new. I nearly loved them. My work demanded no less. I must reach beyond all my particular hatred and pain, see them in their fullness, and then with my pen strike out and destroy them. Every soul sent to freedom was a blow against them. And we did much more than that. We returned the documents edited and augmented, our forgeries encouraged feuds. We altered inquests. We lent proof of fornication. My anger was now free and ranged beyond Maynard and my father, aimed now at all of Virginia, an anger I sated each night under the lanterns at the long library table. When done, I would retire to my bed all worn. In sleep, I escaped the men I studied every day, and instead dreamed of some far place, a small plot, a stream running to carry away all my troubles. I dreamt of Sophia. Those were the good days. On the bad days, my dreams were hot, and I saw the jail, the boy, his mother, raining down the wrath of God upon Ryland's hounds. Ryland's hounds may black fire scorch you down to your vile and crooked bones. I saw a man who loved a woman and lost his name. And I saw all of my own betrayal. The cackling, the moaning, the rope. On those days, I woke up nursing a different feeling, particular and direct, for I awoke thinking of all the things I would do should I ever again cross the path of Georgie Parks. But I had not been brought to the underground for vengeance, nor even mere forgery, but for the power I was believed to bear. If we could only learn to trigger it, to control it and harness it. There was one who knew, one like me but unlike me, she had mastery of this power. In her section of the country, she had become so beloved and famed for fantastic exploits that the coloreds of Boston, Philadelphia, and New York had given her the name Moses. The power she wielded had been dubbed